and welcome back to the True Travel Podcast. I'm Laura Sanders, and this week I'm joined by Tariq Hussein, a British Muslim travel writer and author who's been exploring Eastern Europe in search of its native Muslim communities. Tariq released his book Minarets in the Mountains in July, which is all about his adventures around the Balkans, connecting with Muslim communities who've been there for centuries. During the episode, Tariq talks about the way Muslim heritage has been erased from travel literature by colonial-era writers, and as a result, there's a lot out there that most travellers won't know about. He also talks about the elements of his travels which surprised him, and how they challenged his preconceptions about Muslim identity. Before that, though, I'd like to thank those who've left behind ratings and reviews of the show. The latest one comes from a listener in the Philippines, so a huge thanks. And so if you haven't done so already, please do leave behind a review. I love to see them. And remember, you can see more from Tariq and all of my guests on social media by searching The True Travel Podcast. Tariq, thank you so much for coming on. It's lovely to meet you. How are you keeping?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on. It's wonderful to finally get to do this with you.
Absolutely, yes. I've got you on today to talk a little bit about your new book, Minarets in the Mountains, and your travels around Europe, discovering these indigenous Muslim communities around Europe, which is really interesting, really fascinating, and really insightful. So we'll chat a little bit about that and your travels in general. So to start with, just tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, how did you get into travel writing and what made you fall in love with travel?
Well, I've always enjoyed traveling, as most people do, really. And I really got the bug after my wife and I got married and we'd already had kids. So I haven't been able to do the whole kind of independent backpacking for, I don't know, months and years on end like everybody else. You know, I kind of found myself with a family very early on, and then realized that we really enjoy traveling together. And it's no surprise that the book actually features my family in it. But that's not just because of circumstance, but it's all because the story I tell and the narrative I'm trying to get across through the journey was also important for them as well. But as for when I got excited about traveling, I suppose the first time I stepped on a plane and turned up somewhere new and exciting, I've always been fascinated by difference. I've always been fascinated by things that are, you know, not the norm for us. And I get a great deal of joy from going and exploring and trying to understand and appreciate and engage with it. But in terms of from a travel writing perspective, I really started to get excited and really started to enjoy doing the writing when I began to explore, in some ways, what is my own identity, but also these kind of hidden other narratives that we never really hear about in the mainstream when it comes to popular travel writing or just generally, you know, in mainstream journalism or books and stuff. And I really got excited about trying to tell those other stories through my work.
Yeah, and that absolutely comes through in the book. You know, as you said there, as much as you are Muslim yourself, there's still an element of surprise I felt from you in this book as you discovered some of these communities and you learned more about the history of Europe and the Muslim communities there, which is great. So just going back to your family then, it's interesting that you didn't really get into much travelling until you'd had a family. How do you think it's sort of influenced and impacted your children? Because obviously they've done this from very young with you. And how do you find the whole family travel thing?
It's interesting you say that, because as we started off talking, we said that, you know, I've just come back from Sicily and we've recently acquired a new member of the family. So we were traveling with a toddler again for the first time. And it just reminded us just how different it is to travel with a toddler than it was to travel with teenagers, which is what had been the case in recent years. And we'd kind of forgotten how stressful, how much, you know, care and attention they need and how many things you have to think about. And that kind of chaos and intensity early on was something that then gave way to obviously more and more adventurous journeys like the one we describe in the Balkans, where we're effectively, you know, throwing ourselves into a car for 6 weeks and just moving around and more or less making it up as we go along. And that you can do with, you know, older older children who are used to traveling. Both of my older daughters, Amanian and Anaya, who feature in the book, both of them were traveling literally in the womb. So they got used to traveling from a very early age. And you can see the way it's affected them because they have an openness to things that are different, things that are foreign to them, things that they're not accustomed to. And I feel like the kind of education we get from travel is something you really just can't teach without actually going and having the experience. And of course, all travel writers listening know this, but also we're very privileged to be able to do it. And whilst I do enjoy traveling on my own, which I also do, we as a family are quite kind of accommodating in that way. My wife will go off and do traveling on her own or with other friends. I'll do the same either for work or for my own personal reasons. And I think each type of experience when you're traveling, whether it's solo, with family, with friends, gives you something different. And in each kind of experience, we're learning different things as well. They say you don't really know somebody until you've traveled with them. So when you travel with a lot of people, you suddenly realize you don't really like them as much as you might have thought you do. And vice versa, they're probably thinking the same thing. And of course, that's the same when you're traveling with your family. And, we've had our ups and downs. This particular trip to Sicily was quite challenging because we hadn't done it with a toddler for so long. And we've learned a lot. We came back and we literally kind of did a post-mortem, if you like a reassessment of how we would book things next time and where we would stay and what kind of practicalities we'd put in place that we hadn't thought about this time and been a bit complacent about. So yeah, it's different every time. It's a wonderful thing for them to grow up having done. And both of them have got that travel bug. Although we've been living through a pandemic, both of our daughters are traveling on their own as and when they can. Throughout this summer, my eldest has been going off to different places with friends. So they've clearly got the bug as well. And you can see just how much they get from those experiences.
That's amazing. It's interesting to hear that because just the other day I put a tweet out asking, I get a lot of people saying to me, as someone in their late 20s who will probably have kids in the next few years, oh, well, once you have kids, that's it. You can't travel and all of this, and scaring you almost. So I put a tweet out saying, how true is this? Can't we be both? And it sparked quite the conversation. And some people were like, traveling with kids is very hard. It's very different, which I'm sure it is. And it's put me off. Whereas others are like, no, you can do it. Totally do it. Don't be put off. Don't be scared. So it's just interesting there to hear other people's perspectives.
I think it's really going to be about realizing that traveling on your own and traveling with kids is very different. And what you might have, enjoyed about traveling solo, you won't necessarily be able to do when you're traveling with a family. But then there's other things that you're going to find you enjoy about traveling with the family. But in the same way, you have certain challenges when you're traveling solo. Like when I'm doing a gig for somebody like Lonely Planet and I have to disappear for 3, 4 months, whatever, on my own, I feel very lonely sometimes because I miss my family, I miss my friends. And whilst, hanging out in backpacker hostels and whatever and chatting to people kind of fills that void for a bit. That challenge of waking up every morning on your own and then having to spend the day solo can sometimes be quite challenging. And the reverse, when you travel with your family, you crave that solitude on occasion, and you have to find ways to do that. And me and my wife always make sure when we're traveling with the kids, we give each other that space where, one of us will take control of the situation so the other can go off and have that time. And they're the things you have to learn. And it does help if you, when people have families, when people have children and they want to continue, that they take the time to maybe read books by people who travel with their families, watch YouTubers who do this with their families and learn from those. Because there are certain things you have to adapt and change. And if you do them well, then you will enjoy that experience. And I'm talking as somebody who's got 20 years experience of traveling with a family and telling you that most recently when we went to Sicily, I found we got so many things wrong again. So it is something where you have to relearn how to travel and you just, have to adjust and adapt. But you can get so much joy and a different type of joy from having your children with you on those journeys, just in the same way you're going to have different challenges and, different experiences.
That's great. I'll remember that when the time comes. So let's move on to your book a little bit then. For those listening, it's called Minarets in the Mountains. It's already been shortlisted for numerous awards and in top reads lists. So congratulations. So yeah, just tell us a little bit about it and how it came about.
So it really came about because I wanted to explore a part of Europe that I felt might well be designated as Muslim Europe. And what I mean by that is we often have this perception that the Muslims of Europe are something new, something foreign, something alien. And the region that I travel through actually has Muslim communities that are not only indigenous to Europe, but are at least in some cases, almost 6 centuries old. So these aren't new Muslims. In fact, they're more European than white people are American. So there's nothing new about them. And I wanted to kind of, firstly, it was a journey that I wanted to take with my family because I wanted my children who are of mixed race, but obviously consider themselves European as well as British and everything else. And this was happening around Brexit. So we had that whole backdrop going on as well. I wanted them to go and explore what I felt was our indigenous heritage, if that makes sense, as Europeans. You know, obviously living in the UK, we have a large Muslim community, but almost all of them are the result of recent migration, whether that's post-colonial migration, refugees, whatever. And so we're often a community that has brought with us our identity of what it means to be Muslim to these countries. Whereas here in places like Bosnia, Albania, Kosovo, and the other countries that we visit, you have Muslims who have been living in Europe for centuries and have always been Muslim. So their identity is very much European. And I wanted to go and see what that felt like, what that was like, and be amongst those people, but also explore the amazing 6 centuries of Islamic heritage that is out in these spaces. But also there was also a sense of urgency on my part as well, because my previous journeys to what we call Eastern Europe, and I'll come back to that, my previous journeys to this part of Europe had also shown me that a lot of the Islamic heritage and a lot of the Muslim identity had been consciously and systematically eradicated, either because of communism, the fallout of the Ottoman Empire, or whatever. And for me, that was also a concern, that it was part of what I felt like is a wider attempt to de-Islamize or present Europe as being something that is other than Muslim culture. In other words, to make it seem like Europe has no indigenous Muslim culture or heritage. And of course it does, as my book quite frankly proves, but also anybody that's ever wandered into Bosnia knows that there are blonde-haired, blue-eyed Muslims there who have always been Muslim. You know, anyone that's walked through even southern Serbia will come across, you know, Serbians who are Muslim through and through and have always been Muslim as far as they recall. And so it was interesting when the book came out, because people would say, oh, what do you mean by a Muslim Europe? Because in their head, they don't see an indigenous Muslim Europe in Europe per se. And then when I name the countries, they're like, oh, yeah, of course, because unconsciously, we don't see those countries as Europe proper. And this is where I said to you earlier, I want to come back to this term Eastern Europe. Whenever we talk about these countries that were formerly behind the Iron Curtain, if you like, you know, fell into that whole kind of communist block. Whenever we talk about these, we're always expected to qualify what we say with the term Eastern Europe. And a lot of people think this is just about the fact that they are geographically in the East. And they seem to think it's to do with the fact that they were once behind the Iron Wall. But I argue it's actually a lot more sinister than that. And it's a lot more cynical than that. You know, Eastern has certain connotations, which sadly, you know, we see coming out in politics all the time. Eastern means the Orient. It means the East. It means that is different to us in the West. Okay. And it creates that othering of this space that was historically Muslim. That's when it really began, based on what I've researched. You know, when the literature I've looked at historically, we began to other this part of Europe when it was Muslim. And that's the real reason, in my opinion, that we consider it to be Eastern Europe, because then consciously and unconsciously, we've distanced it from what we consider to be Europe proper, which is the Western half. Now, what's really interesting about this, of course, is one of the countries that is even further east than the countries I've explored isn't considered Eastern Europe. We never, ever seem to be expected to qualify Greece as Eastern Europe. That's really interesting because when you start looking at the cultural underpinning of Western Europe, it's Greco-Roman. And that's the reason why we don't consider Greece as being Eastern Europe, because Greece is something we want. Greek culture is something we want to be a part of Western identity, whereas the Eastern European culture is not something we're so keen to embrace. And we saw all of this kind of outpouring during Brexit, you know, when you saw all this awful, awful narratives being spun and all these awful tropes being marched out about how we'd get so many migrants coming from Eastern Europe and taking all the jobs and all that other nonsense. And it was actually sadly wrapped up with the idea of Muslim refugees as well. And through my research, you know, I've shown in the book that this is an ancient accusation aimed at this part of Europe throughout history, where the Western half has always been terrified of that part of Europe because it was historically Muslim Europe when the Ottomans ruled over it. So it's always been a scary place for the Western half. And of course, even the non-Muslims that lived there, be they the Polish people, be they you know, the people in the Baltic or you know, non-Muslim Serbs or whatever, they all get wrapped up in this and they're all put into the same pot. And this is why we saw this awful kind of outpouring during the whole kind of Brexit tussle in this country. And I don't think it's any surprise that a lot of what I was thinking about sort of germinated during that summer of Brexit when this journey was taking place.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an awful lot packed into there, and you do see this coming out in the book, but also in, you know, not, I don't know how to put it, not such a sort of upfront, obvious way, because it's also a travel log, and you see beautiful places along the way, and you see the beauty of it, and these dainty towns and these historic buildings. But there's also all of this packed into it as well, which you can see coming through. Now, just returning back to this idea of like a stereotype of a Muslim, and the fact that you saw blonde hair, blue eyed Muslims in some countries, and it was, you know, normal. It been like that for centuries. Did that surprise you at all as a Muslim person?
I think it surprised me as far as the fact that it was something that I had also been conditioned into assuming was not a normalized thing. Okay. I've been brought up in Britain. I've been educated through the Western system that I critique in my book as well. So therefore, I'm not pretending for, you know, for one second that I'm immune to a lot of the things that I claim we've all become susceptible to. You know, I will often fall into calling it Eastern Europe as well, and I will often consider Muslims to be people who are generally brown and look like me. And of course, that's not the case. And so there were many things that surprised me. In fact, the whole journey was very much a learning curve for me as well. But because I'd done the research prior to going on the journey and in order to obviously map out where I was going to go, I knew what, that I would come across a lot of this. And yet you can prepare yourself, but then when you meet that person, like in, I don't think I put this in there, but there was a moment where my daughters and I, we were talking outside the cinema to this woman who, you know, without being sort of overly stereotypical, could have come off the cover of Cosmo or Vogue, the kind of, you know, traditional stereotypical blonde, slim, blue-eyed, whatever woman. And she just casually drops in that, you know, as a Muslim, and it caught me off guard, and it caught my daughters off guard because I saw them kind of exchanging glances. And we were all caught off guard, even though we'd been on a trip where we'd met people that looked similarly to her. But it's just one of those things where if you've been conditioned into thinking in a particular way, no matter how much you want to drag yourself out of that, when it happens, it can still catch you off guard. So there were many things about this journey that, you know, surprised me. And you hear that in the book. You know, there were many things I discovered for the first time, like a distinctly European Muslim art style in many of the mosques, which we call the tulip style that was developed in the 17th century. The fact that we came across an entire mystical sect of Muslims that I'd never heard about, who are through and through European because their base is there, all of their lodges are scattered across the Balkans. These are all aspects of what I feel is my kind of European Western Muslim heritage that up until now I had not been privy to. Nobody had told me about it. And so it was wonderful to be able to go, like you say, to these beautiful places, like Sufi lodges perched up on a mountain, like an eagle's nest, and visit it and see it for ourselves and know these things are not just real, they're ancient, they've always been there. So just because somebody else has been telling these stories all this time and for whatever reason left these elements out, doesn't mean they're not there. And I think that's what makes the fact that it was a Muslim telling this story so important. Because as I say in my book, we have had historic travel writers and even modern travel writers who have gone out to these countries, but their radar and their focus has always been switched on to other things. And that's why it's important that we diversify who tells these stories. The travel writing genre has had a massive problem historically. Even somebody like yourself hasn't been represented in that category, because it's usually been a white male who has gone off and written these things, and occasionally maybe a white female, the very privileged white female and the very privileged white male. And the problem is, we've historically assumed, when we've read what they've written, we've taken it as gospel. We've assumed it's somehow kind of objective or something. And this has led to very warped perceptions of places and people. Just like what I was telling you earlier about the way that part of Europe has always been perceived. It's because of the way it's been written about in our language, in the language that we speak in. And I've been susceptible to it as well. I'm sure you recall all the issues I was having unconsciously as we approached Albania because of all the nonsense that is said and written about Albania and still is. And then, I turn up in this place relatively paranoid. And then I realized just how much that was about the baggage I was carrying, and not about Albania itself. And so these are the things that, surprised me a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you should choose to mention Albania because, even now trying to pitch stories about it or mention it in a destination roundup, it's like, I'm not sure our readers would like that. It's crime ridden, it's this, it's that, there's these assumptions. And you're shaking your hands there and you're like, well, we're trying to get people to go off the beaten path and go to different places. And then when you suggest that there are these stereotypes. So yeah, it's really important that other narratives are written. And that was going to be my next question actually was, you've done quite a bit of work around challenging these narratives and making sure that we're including different voices in travel writing because Lord knows it's well overdue. So just tell me a little bit about that. I know you've been involved in lots of TV appearances and podcasts and radio and all of this about, promoting different voices. Why is it so important?
I think, there are two things that we need to think about when we talk about the diversification of travel writing. Often it's assumed that we mean, oh, we need to get different people to write about where they're going and write about travel. And that is important. That's to make sure that going forward, the literary heritage that we will leave behind for future generations is diverse and offers different perspectives on places from around the world, so that people are not just looking at countries through the same narrow lens. So that's one thing. The other thing we need to consider is the literary heritage that we've already inherited. In other words, as people who are fascinated by travel, as people who are into travel writing, especially for somebody like me who likes to write books, I will often then go back to historical travel writing for reference points, for context, to add a bit of color, to bring something to life more. And so when we do that, that's when we see the issues that can come to the fore. For example, if we stick with the Balkans, which is what I've written about, most of the travel writing written in the English language that I could access was written by people who were from the very elite middle and upper classes, generally men, but there were women. And then you have to factor in that that particular segment of society often belonged to what we might call the ruling classes, the colonial classes. And the socio-historical context of those people and that particular past generation of people, when you start to consider what they saw as normal, what they perceived as right and wrong, if we don't kind of unpick that, we will inevitably inherit a lot of what are now going to be perceived as racist, and prejudiced stereotypes and perceptions of these places. Albania being a place we could easily apply that to. So, you know, there are writers who have gone there in the past, somebody like Edith Durham, who's actually really celebrated by Albanians for many wonderful reasons. But people often forget that Edith Durham, for example, was writing at a time when she was part of a class that ruled most of the known world and perceived themselves as being superior to everybody else, just evolutionary wise. And that isn't in question because it was also a time when eugenics had just become popularized. So there was a genuine belief that certain races were more evolved than others, and certain races and certain people deserved to survive and others didn't. We know what happened with this eventual line of thinking, the horrors of the Second World War and so on. But what I'm saying is, what then happens is even somebody who had the best of intentions, and I do believe Edith Durham had wonderful intentions when she went out and wrote about the Albanians and literally put Albanian culture on the map in the West. When you start to unpick the subtleties and the nuances of her writing, you see some really problematic language and some really problematic statements being made. And if these are just repeated, like when we as modern travel writers write about something, we quote these people willy-nilly and we don't think about that, then what we're doing is we're just passing that on to the next generation as well. And it might be more subtle, but it's coming back to what you said earlier. Every time you pitch something about Albania to editors, because they've already inherited that baggage, they're already sitting there thinking, oh, do we really want to talk about, you know, a country that's full of child kidnappers? Now, why do we think that? It's because some of the most popular movies Hollywood's ever produced has depicted them as nothing else. It's horrible. It's absolutely disgusting. You know, anybody who's been to Albania knows just how awful an impact that has had. In fact, the Albanian Tourism Board had to develop an entire counteraction called Taken by Albania because of this. So this is what we've, you know, got to be very, very careful of. One, make sure that everybody is getting a look in when it comes to travel writing so that we get everyone's different perspectives. Because what I see as a Muslim, you won't necessarily see as a non-Muslim, or somebody else who's not straight won't necessarily see, and vice versa. We need all of these perspectives so that we can appreciate that the world is very different depending on who's looking at it. That's the one thing. And the second thing is we really, really must be very careful of taking past work and, you know, repeating those tropes without actually questioning them. So if we see those stereotypes and those prejudices in their writing, we have to call them out. That's not to say throw the baby out with the bathwater. They are a product of, you know, their age and what have you. So we can still take what you might perceive as the good, but be prepared to leave the bad.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I have a whole English literature dissertation on this. I could talk to you about it all night. But I'm not sure all of our listeners would like to listen to those theories. So we'll move on. But some really, really important and interesting points you've raised there. And of course, you know, the more diverse our voices are in travel writing, the more of the world we see. But moving on a little bit, just tell me about, you know, some of the highlights from this trip. What were some of the biggest moments for you and why?
I think some of the biggest moments was really seeing the impact it had on my family, how it was changing their perceptions of what it means to be Muslim. And now, obviously, you know, 6 years, 5, 6 years on, to see how that trip affected them and their sense of being a Muslim and being European. That's one of the great highlights. But also, of course, turning up to stunning places like the Blagaj Teki in Bosnia and seeing this magical, mystical lodge that nobody that I certainly knew personally knew anything about. Or going on a journey with a close personal friend who happens to be Bosnian and wandering around his hometown and him telling me the places where he would, you know, run up a hill with his mates as they tried to bunk off from the boarding school they were stuck in. You know, things like that were really wonderful moments and definitely highlights. Or, you know, another example would be spending that time with my Albanian friend Ida and going to places where he is then saddened by the fact that he doesn't know a lot of the history and the heritage that I am trying to explore. And both of us lamenting the fact that the reason we don't know it is because nobody's doing the job I'm trying to do here, you know? And so those were real kind of highlights. I think the people were massive. They're the real stars of the region. You know, there's this perception that they're hardy and tough. And of course, they're all of those things. And somehow war has turned them into these, I don't know, cold, austere people, whatever you want to call it. And it's nonsense because they're just wonderfully warm and lovely and embracing people. And you know, when you're there, you really feel the kind of accommodating ways in which they embrace you and welcome you. And everywhere we went, we really, really, regardless of whether it was Muslims or non-Muslims that were hosting us or engaging with us, we really felt welcomed and, you know, really felt the warmth of the region.
Amazing. So it's very much the people for you as well as the beautiful land. So for anybody listening to this and thinking, I really like to go and explore some of the Balkans and, you know, delve into some of these communities and see some different sides of the Balkans, where would you recommend? If I gave you a limit of top three places to visit, what would you say?
Well, because a lot of people are being adventurous and traveling to, you know, quote unquote, Eastern Europe, I'm going to talk about the places that they might not expect. So somewhere like Skopje in North Macedonia probably doesn't spring to mind when people think about going for a city break. But this place is littered with stunning Ottoman era history, monuments, beautiful mosques, bridges, an old town, all the cliched things that you expect in a historic space. But it's a place that people very rarely visit. And it's very, very, you know, accessible now as well. Bosnia is increasingly on the list of many, many Muslims for obvious reasons. You know, Sarajevo, once called the Jerusalem of Europe and all of those kind of things. Very, very attractive. Again, wonderful food, wonderful people. And then Albania. You know, without a shadow of a doubt, Albania is one of those places that has such a bad rap that everyone is missing out on these stunning, you know, mountain fairy tale like villages and towns. Everyone is missing out on the exciting capital city, Tirana, and a glorious Adriatic coastline, you know. So, yeah, I'd say those three if you're going to limit me to three.
They sound good to me. I'll be adding them to the list. Finally then, Tariq, what have you got coming up next?
When I went to Sicily, that was part of as well as doing a family trip, obviously, I never really switch off. Travel writers never do. So I did a bit of exploring there as well, looking into some of the history of Sicily, and no doubt something's going to come out of that. Before that, we was in Portugal, which also has a very deep and ancient Muslim history as well. So obviously, that being my specialism, my work will very much focus around that, where I try to kind of bring to the fore a bit more of the kind of untold Muslim narratives of Europe and places where you might not expect to see that heritage, largely because it's my heritage and it's something that I really enjoy exploring at the moment.
And that totally comes through in your book. And it's really refreshing as well to read something from an entirely new perspective. So great stuff, and look forward to seeing what you have coming out next. Thank you so much for joining me, Tariq. It's been a real pleasure. And as I say, we could carry on this whole discussion all night, but I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure to be here.